This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Glenda Jackson, is starring on Broadway in a new production of King Lear, one of Shakespeare's greatest tragedies. Jackson plays Lear, giving her the opportunity to take on one of the most challenging and prestigious roles in theater history, but it's a role that, for obvious reasons, always goes to a man. New York Times theater critic Ben Brantley wrote, "She is delivering a powerful and deeply perceptive performance as the most royally demented of Shakespeare's monarchs." Unquote. King Lear opened on Broadway this month, but Jackson had already played Lear in a London production that opened in 2016 at the Old Vic. Last year, she won a Tony for her performance in the Edward Albee play Three Tall Women. It's been an incredible return to acting after serving 23 years as a member of Parliament. She was elected in 1992 and stepped down in 2015. Her career before that included Oscar-winning performances in the 1969 movie Women in Love and the 1973 romantic comedy A Touch of Class. She won two Emmys playing Queen Elizabeth I in the 1971 BBC series Elizabeth R, which was shown in the U.S. as part of Masterpiece Theater. Let's start with a clip from the new Broadway production of King Lear. Lear has decided that he's old and it's time to unburden himself of his responsibilities as king and divide his kingdom among his three daughters.
Now we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our first intent to shake all cares and busyness from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we, unburdened, crawl toward death.
Glenda Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The first thing people always seem to want to know is, why is a woman playing King Lear, and what's it like to be a woman playing Lear? So you first played him in 2016 at the Old Vic in London. Why did you want to play Lear?
Who would refuse the opportunity to work in a play of that stature? I mean, it is such an extraordinary play. Like all of Shakespeare, essentially, he only asks us three questions. Who are we? What are we? Why are we? And this particular play, it's just astonishing. Human nature is immutable. And so, in a sense, it is the most contemporary play around at the minute. We in England had been engaged in a kind of gender bender war, really, and the marvellous company that was created and succeeded in winning those battles, they did all of Shakespeare's histories with all women casts. And so, in a sense, that battle was over. And what was really one of the really interesting things for me playing it was that nobody ever mentioned the fact that I was a woman playing a man, having seen the play. And also the other interesting thing I found in doing it, when I was a Member of Parliament, part of my duties was to visit old people's homes, day centres, things of that nature. And as we get older, those absolute barriers that define gender begin to crack. They begin to get a little bit foggy and break up. And if you think about it, I mean, when we're born, we teach babies, don't we, to be boys or girls. As we get older, we begin to explore, I think, rather more the alternatives to our defined gender. And that certainly for Lear is quite useful.
I want you to elaborate a little bit on how you see gender boundaries blurring or falling away with age, and to apply it to your own life as well, if you find it applicable.
Well, I think I'm a bit of a cheat, because when things are tough in a kind of direct way in my real life, I don't have any qualms about playing the old card. Do you know what I mean? I mean, certainly as far as our underground is concerned, young people do get up and offer me a seat. The first time it happened, I felt absolutely mortified. I now am beginning to get to the stage where I expect it and am mortified if it doesn't happen, but 9 times out of 10 it does. But in direct reference to the play, the things that he kicks out being, you know, he's a guy, no one during his entire life, and he's 80 years old in this play, has ever said no to him. And suddenly someone does say no to him, and it all begins to crack for him, not in that immediate moment, but that's the story of the play. And so those aspects of him which were overtly masculine, because that was the era in which he lived, the environment in which he lived, begin to move from absolute I'm right and everybody else is wrong, that's a simplistic way of putting it, to actually evaluating whether he was always right. And he begins to doubt it, and that's very interesting.
Are there lines from Lear that have the most meaning to you, either personally, or that you find most powerful or dramatic to say as an actor?
I try to avoid that. I try to observe the world through the character's eyes, but people who see the play do point out lines that are particularly meaningful to them. I always rather regret that they do that, because then it gets kind of stuck in my head and I have to find another way of finding it for the first time, if you see what I mean.
I think I do that. You don't want it to sound like a famous line. You want it to sound like
it is a
speech,
thought.
It's
a direct thought. I mean, it arises out of the scene that you're trying to create with the other actors on the stage, yeah. But, so, I mean, you know, in one's own time, there are lines that sort of reverberate and echo, yeah.
Psychiatrists have tried to diagnose Lear. like, is this dementia related to age? Is it some other kind of, like, cognitive disorder? Is it manic depression? You can read all kinds of things that psychiatrists have said. I know you try to be inside the character, not outside the character. Nevertheless, do you think what he's experiencing is the onset of age-related dementia?
I would think it was somewhat unlikely, given the time in which it was written. People living to the age of 80 would have been a fairly rare occurrence. But nonetheless, it is undoubtedly the case that, as I've said, you know, I've seen it, as we get older, those kind of gender barriers begin to crack. But also, people must have experienced what we are experiencing now, as we are living to a much greater age, of the mixture of what is physical and mental decay. And it is, in fact, I think, a big black hole for most Western democracies. How are we going to cope with this? Because certainly if I look at my own country, we now have a much larger non-working, by virtue of age and retirement, population than a working population. How are we going to look after our elderly if we are all going to go down that road? I know we're not all going to go down that road. And there will be, I have no doubt, advances in medical science. But, you know, it is something that I think we're still tending to think it'll be all right on the night, and it ain't.
So you've played kings and queens. You've served in Parliament. You were elected to Parliament in 1992. You've played powerful people, and you've had political power, not kingly or queenly power.
No. Backbenchers, I cannot stress this strongly enough. For me, one of the most humbling experiences was being a member of Parliament. All members of Parliament hold what we call advice surgeries, and you hold them in the constituency, and any constituent can come in, and they would. And in some instances, in the really serious ones, they sort of lay their life out on the table in front of you. You don't know them. They don't really know you. And not infrequently, their lives are tragic or disastrous through no fault of their own. And they come to their Member of Parliament because that Member of Parliament is their port of last resort. You can get a response to a letter. People will ring you on the phone. In my experience, I didn't always get the result that my constituent wanted. But without exception, whether I did or whether I didn't, they always said thank you. And that is very, very humbling. And it is a great privilege to be elected, to be a Member of Parliament. And that kind of responsibility is something that really makes you realise who you are, and you're pretty damn small.
Yes. Okay. I can see what you're saying. You're helping people with constituent services and things like that. But you also stood up against the Iraq War when Tony Blair joined with President George W. Bush. So you stood up to power in a way that's different from, you know, being an actor. I mean, sure, you might want to stand up and object to direction that you're getting, but it's different than standing up to a prime minister who wants to take your country to war.
Well, as I've had occasion to say, it was the first time in my experience of being a member of parliament that I had voted against my party's policy. And I presume, rather like murder, once you do it for the first time, it gets easier after.
Why did you want to serve in parliament?
Anything I could have done. I mean, I was a member, I've always voted Labour, I've been asked by the party to do various things for them, raise money. I once did the worst party political broadcast ever, things of that nature. And I'd been approached by various constituency parties to consider standing as a prospective parliamentary candidate. And in 92, the election was looming, and I think it was in 1989, I was approached by Hampstead and Highgate, which did indeed become my constituency. Anything I could have done that was legal that got Margaret Thatcher and her government out of office, I was prepared to have a go at. I didn't expect to be selected. I don't think I really expected to win. But we did win that seat. We didn't win the majority to put us into government until 97. But, yeah, that's why.
What made you...
This woman who said, what had the suffragettes ever done for her? That questioned whether there was such a thing as a society that had destroyed local government in many ways, which before her power seat, if that's what it was, you know, was responsible for delivering services to people in local environments. Every school in what became my constituency spent the teachers, parents, not infrequently the pupils, spent spare time trying to raise money to buy things like paper and pencils. I know it sounds ridiculous, but that was the case. Books, you go into school library. I mean, there were these books that were falling apart, or if they were being held together, it was by a bit of wallpaper that the teacher had wrapped it in and stuck down with sellotape. The NHS was being attempted to be restructured.
The National Health Service.
Absolutely.
As a woman who feels strongly about women's equality, and I assume you consider yourself a feminist, was it disappointing to you that finally a woman becomes prime minister and she's so conservative and stands for so many things that you are against?
Well, I mean, the overwhelming disappointment actually was that my party didn't win. I mean, do you know what I mean? At that time. But it was just that she seemed to me to be so out of touch with what were the realities of life for the majority of people in my country. And yes, of course, it was a disappointment that the first woman elected as prime minister was her. But I think rather more at the time it was that she was a conservative. It was only over the years that one saw what were, for me, disastrous policies wreaking such damage.
Let's hear what you had to say in Parliament after Margaret Thatcher died. And this was in 2013. And there were many tributes made in Parliament. And this was a day, I think, when most of the Labour members of Parliament stayed away. And Conservative members were saying, you know, giving many tributes to Margaret Thatcher. And then you stood up and made a pretty scathing speech while Conservative members of Parliament basically jeered you. So let's hear what you had to say.
We were told that everything I had been taught to regard as a vice, and I still regard them as vices, under Thatcherism was in fact a virtue. Greed, selfishness, no care for the weaker, sharp elbows, sharp knees, they were the way forward. We heard much hope and will continue to hear over the next week of the barriers that were broken down by Thatcherism, the establishment that was destroyed.
We can't take it.
What we actually saw, the word that has been circling around with stars around it, is that she created an aspirational society. It aspired for things, as indeed one of the former prime ministers, who himself had been elevated to the House of Lords, spoke about selling off the family silver, and people knowing under those years the price of everything and the value of nothing. What concerns me is that I am beginning to see possibly the re-emergence of that total traducing of what I regard as being the basis spiritual nature of this country, where we do care about society, where we do believe in communities, where we do not leave people to walk by on the other side. That isn't happening now.
Wow. So did you expect that reaction when you decided to make those comments?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, I'd sat there in the chamber for several hours, as one does for these kind of events, before I was called by the speaker. And yes, I mean, I sat there listening to her party rewriting history, as far as I was concerned. The United Kingdom that they were describing under Thatcher was not the one I'd lived in. It wasn't the one my constituents had lived in. And it certainly isn't the one that was there when she left.
Did you miss acting while you were in Parliament?
Oh, no, no. Acting only exists when you do it. So if you're not doing it, there's nothing to miss.
Wait a minute. I miss things I'm not doing.
Like what?
Oh, I miss
That's
seeing friends who I don't
different.
See. You know, I mean, we all miss things that we're not doing, and we miss them because we're not doing them. So,
but the doing is dependent on so much more than telephoning your friend. I mean, this is a process outside of which you are. I mean, the creation of what hopefully someone will suggest you do is outside your remit. And so that's why I say, unless you're doing it, there's nothing to miss.
Okay, let me rephrase this. Did you ever miss the process of getting into a character, learning the role, thinking about the role, thinking about the intentions of the character, and interacting with other actors on a set or on stage to create a scene, to create a movie or a play?
Well, that would presuppose I had nothing to do other than think about I had nothing to do. But I do assure you, being a constituency member of Parliament is a 24/7 job. And what comes through the mail, off the computer, via the phone, I mean, they can be transfixing.
Okay, let me ask this one. See how you respond to this. Now that you're acting again, do you miss being a member of Parliament?
Not at the present time, because of the Brexit quagmire that Parliament has managed to put us in. But I do miss my constituency, yes, mm-hmm. And I miss the people, you know, that I knew there. It was a really interesting constituency to represent.
So it seems like you thought about the possibility of serving in Parliament or doing some kind of public service work back in the 70s. I'm going to play an excerpt of a 1976 interview. You were interviewed by Colin Grimshaw. This excerpt starts with him asking you about what was then your latest film, Nasty Habits, based on a novel by Muriel Sparks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, were you the person who initiated the film?
It was sent to me with the idea of it making a very good film, and making a very good film with lots of good women's parts in it, which is rare.
Are you waving the flag for Women's Lib then? Because they're all women in
it. Waving it? I mean, I'll poke it in your eye.
When you're doing work on stage, do you often get nervous?
Always, always.
Mm. Why? Does it just happen?
Because I think the longer you act, the more you realise you don't know, and the possibilities for making the wrong choices are much greater than the probabilities of making the right ones. And that sort of fear is something that you probably learn to control better, but it doesn't grow any less.
You have said in the past that you might give up acting and take up social work. Mm. Would you do this?
Oh, yes, because, I mean, certainly the life of an actress in films is very short, and in the theatre there's a terrible trough when there are no parts worth playing. I mean, until you sort of hit about 60, and then there are a few sort of cracking character parts, and I really can't see myself hanging around for 20 years waiting to play an old biddy in something, and I certainly don't see myself sitting at home just, you know, polishing the furniture.
But couldn't you see yourself coming back to acting?
Not really, no.
Okay, the one thing that sounds wrong in that is that you did come back to acting, but everything you say in that sounds like so contemporary, a shortage of roles for women, especially at certain ages.
Well, that is an absolute. That has not changed during my experience of you know, acting.
So, in that interview clip, you obviously feel strongly about the women's movement, or women's lib, as he called it.
What I really, really feel strongly about, and I wish I could come up with the reason for it, is why contemporary dramatists find women so boring. They are rarely, if ever, the driving dramatic engine of a play or a film or you know. And I don't know why that is. I mean, we are by no means equal as a gender, or certainly not worldwide, but there have been major improvements. Doors have opened for women that were firmly locked many decades ago. Why don't contemporary dramatists find us interesting? But they don't.
So, I mean, you are so work-oriented. Parliament was just like a more than full-time job for you, ditto with acting, and now certainly doing Lear. How do you feel about the possibility of retirement?
Well, if I don't get offered work, then I'll be retired, and fair enough. You know, I've had a good run.
What do you think you would want to do with your time?
Well, I like gardening. And I'm a grandma, so I get grandma duty, which is an interesting experience.
Is it different than being a parent?
Absolutely.
Are you enjoying
it more?
You
can send them home.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Glenda Jackson is now starring in a new Broadway production of King Lear in the role of Lear. Since the early 20th century, the word socialism has lived on the fringes of American political discourse. Now suddenly it's at the forefront of the national conversation. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the label that came in from the cold.
Time was when the word socialism had a firm footing in the American political lexicon, with all the meanings it has collected in the other nations where it's taken root. It could be mixed or pure, planned or market, a dogma or simply an aspiration, the name of our desire, as the critic Irving Howe famously defined it. But after the American socialist movement crumbled in the 1920s, the right compacted the word into a single term of abuse. It became the S-word, which is the title that John Nichols of The Nation magazine gave to his recent history of socialism in America. From Social Security and unemployment insurance to Medicare and the Affordable Health Care Act, Republicans have labeled every social welfare program proposed by Democrats as socialist, socialistic, or creeping socialism, a phrase coined by Thomas Dewey in 1939. Give socialism a foothold, they'd say, and nothing can arrest the slide to perdition. In 1936, Herbert Hoover said that FDR's socialist policies were leading America on a march to Moscow. With the fall of the Soviet Empire half a century later, Republicans had to redirect that road to a warmer destination. As Vice President Pence told the Conservative Political Action Committee last March, "We know where socialism needs. Just look at Venezuela." But the logic hasn't changed since Hoover's time. Passing universal health care or a $15 minimum wage is like picking up a Monopoly card that says, "Go directly to Caracas. Do not pass Stockholm." Until recently, Democrats dismissed those charges as fear-mongering. In 1952, Harry Truman called socialism a scare word and said that when a Republican says down with socialism, he really means down with progress. But the S-word isn't quite as spine-chilling now, particularly to millennials. They have no memory of the Cold War. They can't tell you what the second S in USSR was for. And the fall of the Berlin Wall is just one of a mash of 80s film clips along with the Exxon Valdez, Pac-Man, and Boy George. The upheaval that shaped their political perceptions was the financial meltdown of the mid-2000s. That made them keenly aware of the mayhem that Godzilla capitalism could wreak, and of the economic inequality that the Occupy movement captured with quantitative precision with the new phrase, the 1%. Socialism began to sound like a needed corrective, particularly once it was personified by a cantankerous old senator from Vermont and a young congresswoman from New York with a digital native's talent for social media. Both of them avowed socialists, as the media sometimes described them, in the way they've traditionally referred to avowed atheists and avowed homosexuals. By 2018, a majority of millennials said they had a positive view of socialism, including quite a few Republicans. Not all of those who look kindly on socialism go on to label themselves as socialists or democratic socialists. To many of them, the word evokes phrases like the social contract, another term that's been in the air a lot lately. But however they describe themselves, the great majority of millennials associate socialism with New Deal-style programs like universal health care and access to free higher education, not state control of business. And while they give low marks to capitalism, they aren't hostile to free markets. In fact, an overwhelming majority say they approve of the free enterprise system. That's not a contradiction. It's the difference between accepting the rules of the game and saying it could be played a little more decently. After all, you can love football but hate the NFL. The fact is that most of the millennial fans of socialism don't see the role of government that differently from the people who still call themselves progressives or liberals, though they tend to be more dogged about it. To conservatives, that just means that millennials don't know the true meaning of the word socialism. Conservatives often seem to assign magical powers to the word. Call yourself a socialist and you summon the specter of Stalin, whether you meant to or not. You think you're calling for guaranteed health care, but you're really calling for gulags and collectivization. Actually, as John Nichols points out, the recent popularity of socialism has a lot to do with the way conservative media slathered the word over Barack Obama and his programs, both of which were fairly popular. That's a risk Republicans run when they frame the Democrats' positions as socialistic. They may inadvertently detoxify the brand, particularly when the connections to Marxism are hard to discern. Senator McConnell recently denounced what he called the Democrats' radical, half-baked socialist proposal to make Election Day a federal holiday. But more than two-thirds of Americans think that's a good idea. And if that makes them socialist, well, what's to be frightened of? A lot of voters are still skittish about socialism, so that all the Democratic hopefuls other than Sanders have had to forswear the label. Though, as the Florida Democrat Andrew Gillum noted, it's not as if that will stop Republicans from calling them socialist anyway. But it's no longer exclusively the Republicans' word to define or demonize. It's a contested label now, just as conservative is on the right. It isn't yet clear where socialist will settle in the vocabulary of the American left as it jostles with labels like liberal and progressive. But it's not the S-word anymore. That might be the most consequential change in American political language since the era when Herbert Hoover was walking the earth.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Coming up, we'll hear from New York Times baseball columnist Tyler Kepner. His new book is called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest is New York Times national baseball writer Tyler Kepner. He's the author of the new book K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. It's about the countless ways pitchers have learned to make the ball dance and dart on its way to the plate. He writes about fastballs, screwballs, and knuckleballs, as well as the shady pitches, spitballs, greaseballs, mudballs, and baseballs doctored with sandpaper, thumbtacks, or even the sharp edges of a catcher's shin guard. As part of his research, Kepner interviewed 22 Hall of Fame pitchers. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Tyler Kepner, welcome to Fresh Air. Well, if I have a favorite chapter, it's the one about the spitball, spitters. Pitchers have been doctoring baseballs for a long time, and the stories are endless. Give me one of your favorites.
A lot of guys still don't want to sort of admit to their trickery on the mound, but sometimes when they get caught and it's a big public thing, they really have nowhere to hide. So I was a little embarrassed talking to Rick Honeycutt, who was the longtime pitcher mostly for Oakland and some other teams, and now he's been the pitching coach of the Dodgers for a long time. I was a little bit embarrassed to ask him about sort of the worst moment of his career, but he took it in good humor. When Rick Honeycutt was a young pitcher for the Seattle Mariners in 1980, he had made the All-Star team, but the second half of the season was just a fiasco. He couldn't get anybody out, it felt like, and he was losing. It was a big losing streak. And so before a late season start in Kansas City, he absentmindedly passed a bulletin board and he saw a thumbtack, and he got the brilliant idea to put a thumbtack in his glove and see if he could just scratch the ball in the strategic location and get the ball to have a little more movement and maybe change his luck a little bit. Of course, this was illegal, but he was desperate and willing to kind of cross over into the dark arts of the game. There was no MLB Network back then. I don't even know if the game was televised, so not as many prying eyes as you have today from the cameras. So he thought he could get away with it, but the problem was, first of all, it wasn't working too well. One of Rick's problems this day was that the home plate umpire was a guy named Bill Kunkel, who had happened to pitch for the Yankees a little bit with Whitey Ford, who was well known for defacing the baseball late in his career and having many ways to get a little scuff on the ball to
the mud ball, give it right?
the mud ball. His catcher Elston Howard would sort of subtly scratch the ball with his sharp edge of his shin guards before he threw it back to him. So Bill Kunkel, the umpire, knew what a defaced baseball looked like and how it behaved, and so it wasn't very long until he asked to see what was in Rick Honeycutt's glove, and he saw the thumbtack, and he threw him out of the game. And Honeycutt thought he might have been banned from baseball. He was young and nervous, and he didn't know what was going to happen. And he got a little suspension, but the Mariners ended up trading him, and he pitched 17 more years in the big league. So I guess it was their loss. They should have held on to the young cheater and believed in him because he had a long career ahead of him, and he never scuffed again.
And a ball that has tobacco juice, spit, mud, hair cream, what does it do?
The guys who would do it back in the day, they could make sure that it was on one side and not the other. If you have it overloaded on one side, the aerodynamics are just going to affect the flight of the ball differently. If you think about the way a baseball is shaped with the seams and the smooth edges on the ball, the leather, if one of those is different than the other, whether it's tobacco juice or overloaded with Vaseline or a scuff or dirt or something, it's going to move differently. And the pitchers do enough experimenting to know that, if you've got something on this side and not on this side, it's going to break a different way.
So besides cutting the ball and scuffing it with sandpaper or tacks, they would put tobacco juice on it. They would put Vaseline, right, and hair cream. In fact, wasn't there a commercial that Don Drysdale made to spoof all this thing?
Yes, in 1968, Drysdale threw a record until Oral Hershiser broke it 30 years later, a record 58 and two-thirds consecutive scoreless innings, and he found a way to capitalize on his well-founded reputation for occasionally throwing a spitball, a greaseball, by getting a commercial for Vitalis Hair Tonic. And in this commercial, he looks in for the sign against a Giants hitter, and the hitter calls timeout, and Drysdale casually removes his cap and runs his fingers through his hair. And Herman Franks, the Giants manager, bolts out of the dugout, and he says, "Greaseball, greaseball, see him rub his hair? He's going to throw a greaseball. That's illegal." And so Drysdale grimaces, and he's disgusted. He tosses his glove on the grass, and he goes back to the clubhouse, and there he finds a bottle of Vitalis and returns to the mound and holds the bottle high for all to see. And the announcer says, "Vitalis has no grease and spreads easily through your hair. If we all use Vitalis, we could help put an end to the grease ball." So it was just having fun with it.
So does it still happen? Do we still see doctored balls?
Well, the consensus is that there's not the kind of classic spitball or using Vaseline or anything like that we would see so much through the 60s and 70s. Just because there's so many cameras now and people who are literally, it's their job to watch film and look for anything that a pitcher is doing different. We have data and technology that can capture just how much a pitch is moving, and if something is out of the ordinary, you're going to spot it really quick. What is sort of tacitly allowed now, not by the rules, but sort of by the way that hitters act, is just getting a better grip on the ball. Hitters don't want a ball to slip out of the pitcher's hands. That can be literally a deadly weapon in a pitcher's hand. They want pitchers to know generally where the pitch is going to go. So pitchers have ways of concocting a substance that can give a little more tackiness to their fingers. Let's say a combination of rosin and bullfrog sunscreen, and or you know, colorless, odorless tough skin, which is kind of something you can use to make tape stick on your wrist or something. You just put a little dab of that. A former hitter showed me how to do that, and just a little spray on your arm. No one can see it, but it creates a little oasis of tackiness on your arm. And so between pitches, a pitcher can just sort of casually touch that spot and no one might even notice, but you get a little more of a grip on the ball. And that's generally okay as long as it's not overt, as long as it's subtle.
One fascinating story about pitchers sharing skills with another involves Roy Halladay, the late player for the, you know, pitched for the, I guess, Toronto and for the Phillies, and how he learned the cutter from the master of it, Mariano Rivera, when they were together at the All-Star game.
Yeah, and I thought that that story, first of all, took on an added, you know, poignant element because they both were elected to the Hall of Fame this year in the same class. And of course, Roy died in a plane crash, and he won't be there for the ceremony, but he has this connection with Rivera because of the pursuit of excellence. I mean, if you're at the All-Star game, you're already obviously an All-Star. You're one of the best. But Halladay took the opportunity in 2008, being a teammate with Rivera just for a couple days, to ask him about the cutter. It is the pitch that made Mariano famous and took him to the Hall of Fame. And Halladay threw it, but he didn't feel like he was throwing it well. He thought that he was doing something wrong with how his fingers were placed on the ball, his thumb placement in particular. And so he went to Rivera and he said, I think I'm doing something wrong with my cutter. I think this pitch could be better. How do you hold yours? And Rivera showed him, and Rivera was very open about it. And Halladay noticed that his thumb was in the wrong place. And so once he made that adjustment, just by tucking the thumb under the ball rather than just holding it sort of parallel to his index finger, then the pitch started behaving just the way he wanted. And what Halladay did was he took a pen and he traced his fingers on the ball, just as Rivera had showed him. And then whenever he would get out of whack for the rest of his career, he would have that ball in his travel bag and he could just put his fingers in the Rivera spots and know that that was where they needed to be. And really, it took him to the Hall of Fame because he was already great. But those next 3 years, 09, 10, and 11, he threw the cutter more than any other starting pitcher in baseball, and he had three of the best years of his career. And without that last burst of dominance, I don't think he would have made it to Cooperstown.
What always surprises me about that story is that, I mean, these are two pitchers that are pitching in the American League at the same time. And right. I just wonder how Mariano Rivera's teammates on the Yankees feel about how him instructing this guy, who they're going to face, on how to throw this nasty pitch which gets them out. I mean, isn't right. there kind of a competitive yeah. loyalty here?
Well, yeah, they ended up finding Mariano in Kangaroo Court. You know, there were all these various non-offensive, you know, crimes. They'll dock their teammates a few bucks here and there. So they did, you know, Halladay was always really tough on them, and he got even tougher, and they were like, really, Mariano? Come on. You couldn't have held that one back a little bit. But I think it's part of the brotherhood of pitchers that you're going to help each other, because even if you show someone the grips, that it's still up to the player to not just put in the time, but also get lucky enough to have the right physiology for it. I mean, a lot of these guys can't throw a certain pitch. So Mariano can teach that cutter to anybody he wants, but only a select few can have anywhere close to the success he had with it.
Pitchers have all kinds of grips that impart all kinds of spin on balls. You know, there are sliders and spitters and screwballs and all of these things. And hitters have to try and recognize them and anticipate how they might break. Can they tell from the spin on the seams what's coming at them?
Sometimes a slider, for example, a lot of hitters will say they look for the red dot in the way the ball's red seams are sort of coming together. And if it's a big sort of dot the size of a quarter, then it's what they call a cement mixer, and it's just sort of spinning there, obviously, and it's not going to do much. But then again, you've got a guy like Matt Williams, who played a long time for the Giants and Arizona Diamondbacks and some other teams. He said he took 7,000 at-bats in the big leagues. He said he never saw the dot on a slider. He's like, I'm not saying it's a myth. I'm just saying I never saw it. So, you know, a pitcher who could throw a slider without a dot for anybody, a guy like Brad Lidge for the Phillies, had a big advantage because hitters just didn't know what they were looking at. But yeah, some pitches have telltale spin. I talked to Wade Boggs about it. I looked at his stats. I said, how are you able to hit split-finger fastball pitchers so well? And he said, well, I could see the ball tumble. I could pick up the action on the ball, and I could tell when it was going to tumble. And based on where he was throwing it, I knew where it was going to end up. But I said, well, how'd you do that? He said, well, I had 20/12 vision. So when my vision got a little worse and it went back to 20/20, I couldn't see the tumble and I struggled just like everyone else. So I'm like, okay, well, if you have Wade Boggs' hitting skills to begin with and you have 20/12 vision, then maybe you can see the tumble on a split finger fastball. But for the rest of us mere mortals, it's going to be tricky.
Let's talk a little bit about the state of the game in 2019. Pace of play is a big thing these days. I mean, it just seems that games take forever. Are they slower? What are the rules that are being imposed to try and move the game along?
Well, mainly they're cosmetic. They got rid of the intentional walk, at least the aspect of having to go through with throwing the pitches. If you want to intentionally walk a guy, the umpire just waves him down to first. But most games don't even feature an intentional walk, so that's not going to do much. They shaved 5 seconds off of commercial breaks. Again, it's not much that you're going to notice. They tried to regulate how many mound visits you can take, not necessarily just the pitching coach, but even a fielder coming over and talking to a mound. It was 6 last year and now 5. But most of those things really don't affect the pacing of the game. The biggest factor is that there are so many strikeouts now and that pitchers need obviously 3 pitches to strike out a batter, and there's probably going to be a ball or two in there and a foul ball. So hitters have also learned that the more pitches they see, the better they are paid. And so it pays to draw walks. It pays to work deep counts and run up the pitcher's pitch count and get him out of the game and force him into a mistake. Really, if you think about it, just mathematically, the more pitches you see in at bat, the better chance you have that the pitcher will put one in the wrong location and that you can take advantage of that. So the more pitches there are, the longer the game's going to be. And as long as hitters are incentivized to see a lot of pitches, I think baseball is going to have a really, really tough time trying to cut down on the time of game.
Is there any restriction on how long a batter can take? I mean, is the batter always allowed to step out of the batter's box, stretch, take a couple of swings, tighten each of the batting gloves, and get back in, which takes 30 seconds?
They've tried to tighten that up, too. If you don't foul the ball off or swing and miss or something, you're supposed to keep yourself in the box the way guys used to. That has helped a little bit. It's easier to enforce in the minor leagues because, you know, the major leagues umpires just generally still let hitters, for the most part, do what they want to do up there. You don't see this big epidemic of calling a ball on the pitcher who dawdles or calling a strike on the hitter who takes too long.
But they can?
They can, I mean, by the letter of the law, but you just don't see it. Mostly pitchers will get a fine, a nominal sort of slap on the wrist from the league. It's something that baseball is always aware of because baseball just does have a different pacing naturally than other sports. But baseball is really worried about the more strikeouts than hits thing because they will tell you that it's time of game, but more importantly is the pace of the action. They want more balls in play. And pitchers are just so good now. They throw so hard and they have such sophisticated breaking balls that pitching is harder to hit. We see more foul balls than ever because hitters can't square these pitches up. And also somewhat of it's tactical by the hitters. They realize that pitching is so good that what are the odds of getting 3 hits in an inning, 3 singles to score a run? It's probably easier to hope that a pitcher will make a mistake and that you can put a ball over the fence and get a run that way. So there was a record number of home runs in 2017. The 2019 pace is up there too. And so home runs are up and strikeouts are up. And what does that mean? There's not a lot of balls in play. And that's where the action happens. That's where possibilities are. That's where you get guys on base to steal a base or bunt a guy over. All those things are sort of being lessened in the game as we gear more and more up for home runs or strikeouts. And that's a problem for MLB, and they don't quite know how to solve it.
I wonder sometimes if our expectations are not changed by living in a digital age where, you know, we're always entertained by our smartphones and other screens, and we just have less patience for a game that moves slowly.
I think there's something to that. I think, though, also that I've been hearing these things about baseball's pace. I'm 44, and I've been hearing them since I was 14, probably, that baseball was too slow for kids, and it was not fast-paced like basketball or hockey or soccer. And I still think, you know, you could pass out as many surveys as you want that say football is the number one sport and all that, but I think it's a dishonest comparison because football has 16 games a year. Baseball has 162 games a year with an industry of 30 teams. Most of them do quite well. There's only one or two teams that continually struggle with attendance, two or three teams, let's say. Attendance was down last year, and that was an issue, but they still, it's a $10 or $11 billion industry. You have a minor league system that is spread out all across the country in small towns everywhere, and people watch games, whether in person or on television, at just tremendous numbers. Baseball does struggle nationally to get ratings that they used to, but locally, these teams tend to do great. The point is, you know, like the first game in the history of the Mets in 1962 or the Padres in 1969, there were acres of empty seats. Like baseball now is a happening, whereas in this golden era that we remember, it just wasn't that way. New York only had one team in 1958, 59, 60, 61. I mean, baseball is doing pretty well when you put it in a historical lens. And yes, they have problems with pacing, but I think it'll sort itself out.
Well, Tyler Koeppner, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Tyler Koeppner is a national baseball writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.